And welcome to Notes of the North Talks, a series where we get to know our local Canadian musical talent. Today, I'm here with Nicole Lizet. Thank you so much, Nicole, for joining me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me here.
First things first, Nicole, where are you joining us from today? Where in Canada do you call home?
I am in Montreal, and specifically in Lachine, very close to the airport.
Ooh, awesome. Now, rapid fire. Could you describe your compositional style in 5 words?
Okay. The first word I would say is personal. Everything is meaningful to me. I would say uncompromising. I'm going to say idiosyncratic. Ooh. And how many is that? That's 3, right? Unquantized, a word I use a lot lately, but I won't, like, won't go into details yet. And to pigeonhole-less.
Ooh, tell me more.
So the first word, personal. Every project I undertake, and it's always been like this. I would say for 99%, if not higher, of the projects have all been driven from a place from, you know, something that has deep interest to me and deep meaning to me. And even if I don't, well, it's impossible to know this, and I don't spend time thinking about this, but even if it doesn't necessarily, it's not necessarily in fashion or what have you. I mean, I don't think about these things too much, but it's also it always comes from a place that has deep meaning for me. So everything is personal, referencing things that may be kind of obscure or something, but drives the project and the piece, because there's so much. I'm so driven by the subject matter, or even if there are new things learned along the way from collaborators or what have you, it has to mean something to me. So it is, every project and every piece I write is personal. And uncompromising and unquantized sort of are in the same ballpark, in that I don't smooth the edges, even if in many ways, the subject matter, the topic, again, if it's not something that is outside the box or outside the parameters of what usually is, you know, sort of acceptable in concert music, or, and I'm talking over many decades, years or decades of working, if something's not immediately accessible or, you know, put in the proper word there, doesn't really factor into it. So, and even in orchestration choices, using, you know, obsolete equipment or things that need work to locate and learn and write for. And even in the way I notate or orchestrate, I don't want to round things off. So, you know, will require a certain approach of orchestration that may require a sort of a different way of looking at the score in order to perform. And then, yeah, and the other words are sort of straightforward, idiosyncratic. You know, everything has been sort of a personal style. I didn't really at all attempt to emulate any existing composers. It kind of, I was on my own for a long time and just sort of developed my own voice and had ideas even from a young age of what I wanted to do and how I wanted things to sound. And it seemed just logical and natural for me to pursue that, sort of putting blinders on and moving forward. So yeah, those are sort of, yeah, descriptions of the rapid fire, which is not so rapid fire. So I'm sorry.
That's awesome. And now, for someone who might be new to your work, what do you think would be a recommendation of a first piece that would really get them started on your style?
Oh, great question. Oh, maybe, you know, a piece from 2007, titled This Will Not Be Televised, which was my second piece for turntables, and I really was able to delve deeper into turntablism. It followed my 1999 piece that I did for my thesis, which was my first piece for turntables, my concerto called RPM, and that might also be a good piece to check out. But I think that, and I realized that's also, or a piece, you know, I've recently, from a couple of years ago, my opera RUR, which has a lot of, you know, when I was speaking earlier about not quantizing and being uncompromising, certainly, especially in an opera setting, that might also be a piece that, you know, in that piece, it involves tech, it involves wardrobe, it involves multimedia and unrelenting, you know, percussion ideas that and vocal ideas that I just really went pretty deep into that.
Oh, very exciting. We're definitely going to talk more about that soon. Now, if we could peer into your creative process on a typical day, what might we see you do? Any habits or rituals before you start, for example?
Well, probably not a surprise, coffee, right? Caffeine. I mean, yeah. I do oftentimes, there is a ritual, but oftentimes it starts depending on the task at hand. If I have a major deadline that I write right away. So, I mean, a typical day would be, I do a lot of reading sometimes to just, get not inspired, but just sort of to sort of kick off the adrenaline kind of thing. I do write every day. There's very rarely where I'm not writing something, even if it's not actual notation, it's ideas about something. I have always found it important to keep something nearby where I'll jot down conceptual notes or I'll sing into a recorder, or I'll work with a piece of tech so every day, I mean, a typical day is getting up, coffee, lots of writing, reading, since I do a lot of multimedia, there's also what I reserve usually later in the day for technological kind of focus. So that involves reading, trying new skills, kind of acquiring new skills. So I find that important, not every day for that, but certainly several times a week.
Awesome. And going off of this theme of technology now, could you tell me about the moments in the beginning that sparked this interest in exploring non-traditional orchestral instruments and technology in your compositions?
Yes. Actually, it started very young age, because my father is an electronics salesperson, repairman, and collector. So I was sort of born into that environment. He still doesn't throw anything away. He kept everything. And so I was surrounded by technology. And so when I was starting to, as a young person, there were also instruments in the house. So the instruments were in a vicinity in the house, sort of surrounded by all this tech that was malfunctioning. And because, I mean, many things would work, but many things didn't. And everything was analog then. So there were actually devices that would still work. They wouldn't shut down, but they wouldn't work according to the manufacturer's specification. So they were of no use to the public, so to speak, but they were still sitting there and making, crazy, amazing sounds that I was immediately drawn to. So those just seemed natural to write for them and to try and recreate those sounds or try to merge them with the instruments that were around the house, piano, guitar. Later, I got a drum kit, electric guitar, and I would sing, along with them. So once I started notating it didn't leave. It was completely, sort of burned into my brain, into my subconscious. They were instruments, and those sounds could only be created by those very machines.
Mm-hmm. Wow. What's been like a really unique piece of this technology that you've used that really stuck in your mind?
Oh, so many. Well, I would say the RCA Selectivision, which was very short-lived, but I think about this machine a lot, and I have one. I mean, and my dad still has them. It's a little hard to describe. It's large. It's not a laser disc, but it's as large as a laser disc. And it has a stylus in there, and it came around in the mid to late 70s, and you had to load it into this machine and take it out, load it in, let it do its thing, which was also always very noisy and also very fascinating to me. Take it out, and there were movies, but the thing is, there was a selection of movies, and it lasted for a period of years. So there were very limited number of movies, certainly, that I was aware of. Anyway, every time it was played, it would break down. It would still play, but the movie itself would start to degrade. So in a very quick way. So it would get chewed up, it would skip, it would, the colors would saturate. And it was very, so the movie, two things were happening. The sound and the vision, the visuals were incredible. I mean, they would change every time you played that movie back. And it would sort of take over the narrative of the movie in a musical way, in an artistic way. No, the narrative was no longer serving the purpose. You didn't care about the story. It was, you never knew what you were going to get. And so it had a life of its own. It had its own soul, so to speak. So I would say, yeah, I would say the RCA Selectivision. I love it because of what it did to me. I mean, I had a huge impression from a very young age, and I was always excited to see how a certain film would behave that day. And the fact that it's, you know, it's such a precious piece of equipment that it failed, but made such an impression, you know, so it's, nobody will speak of it because it's essentially a failure, but it's so artistic, and it looked beautiful. It was wood paneling, you know, the big, massive kind of pieces of equipment that is synonymous with the 70s kind of thing. Everything was so huge, you know, and so much care was put into it.
That's so fascinating, especially the part where you said it produces these images that are never produced again. What role does this aleatoric element play in your works, especially within the context of music we know that is constantly repeated over and over in identical form?
Yeah, that's a great question, and something that I think a lot about, because it's based on error and it's not dependable and it could break down at any moment. I mean, the machines that I have, some of them I used to take on tour or perform with, and some of them I won't anymore. I was sort of more, as when I was younger, I was not so concerned with, I just wanted, no matter, you know, it had to have that machine in it. And now I have sort of developed an emotional attachment to this machine. I want to take care of it. And, you know, but at the same time, yeah, having that unpredictable element it's hard for me to articulate. I mean, because I wanted to harness it, and I've sort of devoted my career, my output, to harnessing that sound. That is, so it, what it did essentially was sort of inject the spirit of that machine into the way I write. Even if I can't use that machine or it's independable, I still want it there for its beauty and the fact that it's unpredictable and can't be tamed, kind of thing. But it made an impression on the way I approach music, because when I talk about the unquantizing, not quantizing anything, that's exactly what I mean. Because if things were quantized, then that sort of erratic, irrational, you know, spirited kind of sound that, or sound and visuals that I experienced, it wouldn't be the same. So it really affected the way I notate and the way I orchestrate and the way I approach art, I guess, overall, that unpredictability. But at the same time, yeah, the machine itself is just, you know, it's not dependable. There's a beauty in that. There's a beauty in that.
That's really beautiful. In addition to composing, you're also a filmmaker and video artist. So how do your visual and musical worlds overlap in your projects? Like, how do visual elements influence your music and vice versa?
Yes. Yeah. In a word, absolutely. Absolutely. And again, referencing back to when I was watching movies, I mean, the movies were played back on this device that was a musical instrument. But at the same time, I was watching, you know, visuals. I was looking and initially watching, you know, it was a lot of the same movies too. So that made an impact, kind of became obsessed with certain directors and certain films. And the way the direction went, the cinematography, the editing played a huge part. Observing the way other filmmakers would approach editing and cinematography. I thought, not every time would I think visually when I'm writing a piece, but oftentimes I do. Even if it's not intended to be visual, it's still expressive in the way that cinematography is. So when I started making my own films, I started by editing pre-existing found footage into musical works. So editing started first, and then I gradually, you know, I was at the same time was learning about cameras and learning about cinematography and reading a lot of books about directors and their approaches, and started getting into animation and things like that. So yeah, when I write these pieces, it always has been that way too, where one cannot exist without the other. They have to be completely embedded. So there can't be, the music can't simply accompany the visuals, and the visuals can't just, be there arbitrarily while music is going on. So they have to be completely, they have to coexist equally together. And that's why I write everything simultaneously, and I write the visual component into the score so that it becomes a chamber musician.
Now, you work so much with technology, so I'm really interested in hearing your thoughts about the speed of innovation nowadays and the contexts of modern technology. Could you speak a little to that?
Yes. I think that innovation has always happened quickly. It's just that we're hearing about it quickly as well. We're part of the innovation, and the technologies included, immediate, instantaneous news. So we hear about things. Whereas when I was, when I'm talking about what people refer to as a golden age of technology, which occurred in the 70s and 80s, things were being invented and beta tested very rapidly, with the advent of video games, with home media, with it was one thing after the other, satellite dishes, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there were always machines arriving, but it was happening often quietly. We wouldn't hear about it until it was for sale, and then it was already, thinking about the next thing, the next thing. I think now it's so instantaneous, and it's also in. It's not really tangible. It happens, the much of the tech that exists now is not, it's in the ether. If you're downloading, if you're accessing devices now online, if they're purely digital, then it's a very different experience than analog. But they're both very, very, very progressive times.
Turning a little bit back, I think we touched on it a little bit already, but your works incorporate these unconventional instruments like turntables, vintage board games too, I think I saw. How do you approach this process of writing for them?
For the actual notation of
Yes.
these, yeah, I love this challenge, and it is a challenge. But I started just embracing it again from a young age, wanting these devices again considered legitimate or considered a real member of the ensemble, and so that it could, in order for the piece to be played, the ensemble or the organization had to also make room, make space for this element, and learn about, find it, learn about it, and then so in order for that to happen, it really has to be embedded into the score. It has to be notated. So when I was writing for turntables in for my thesis, I had to devise a notation where everything had to be specific. I didn't want the turntablist to just play over top of some stuff. I wanted it to be like a chamber piece where every member of the ensemble has a part and plays together and listens to each other. And the interesting thing about turntablism is that you have the turntables, but you also have the media. You have another component, which is the LP, which also contains, in and of itself, it contains tempo, sound, dynamics. So that has to be written for as well. And I loved doing that. I loved the challenge of harnessing that, but it had to happen. I didn't want anything to be arbitrary. I really wanted everything. I wanted the tempo changes, and not only the tempo changes in the LP, but the way the turntablist will manipulate that. If you put your hand on the surface of a record and push it, it'll speed up, it'll slow down, that sort of thing. It'll reverse. And I wanted to write that in. And that sort of forced me, or it made me look deeper into tempo, into rhythm, into meter, into feel, because everybody has to listen to each other. And you have the conductor too, but the records are also a conductor, because they have their baked in tempos and sound overall. So for every device that I've sort of embraced along the way, it's been essential to find an effective notation for them. So all of them have their own, you know, I'll use a combination. I'll often use notation as much as I can, sort of traditional notation, but I'll put in, you know, there are lots of explanations or text or and often if they're in the case of a record of vinyl, I will write, I'll transcribe. I learned to transcribe very, very early on too. Transcribe that particular, not only the excerpt, but also the way the excerpt is manipulated by the turntablist, so that it coincides with whatever's going on in the orchestra. It has to match up. So yeah.
Wow. And as someone who works with so many gadgets, do you have any personal favorite tools or objects that you couldn't live without, both musical or technological?
I so much like my father, I very rarely throw, like, I collect things. And so I would say that can't live without is loaded thing. I mean, I don't know, but I would be sad if I were, for example, the Selectivision that I have, or the Atari 2600, that these are from my childhood. These are the very, and I have the movies that go with them. So a lot of times I will talk about, when I was talking about the RCA, the discs, the video discs that would seriously get glitch. One of them was the Franco Zeffirelli version of Jesus of Nazareth. And so I have this very disc set that is heavily glitched, that, you know, that is from my youth. And that is what sort of impressed upon me. That is that movie that would change every time I become evil and psychedelic. And, you know, King Herod, when he announced that he was going to kill all these babies, it suddenly, you know, it wasn't just that. It was the fact that his face turned purple and, you know, suddenly warped and started being chewed up. So I have these very discs. And then, you know, things like records I can't live without, or the old board games that I have too, that are so inventive from a long time ago, that have, you know, they're really inventive, and they have, you know, some that have components built into them. People put a lot of effort into the creativity of these games. And lots of miniatures. I collect miniatures, and some of them are really, I've only seen one of them, you know, that exists. They're all, and they're so detailed, and they're so well crafted. And I would also say physical books and magazines that are disappearing. I've tried, you know, I can do the online thing, and I do all the time, but there's a beauty about having an actual book, especially one that is old and you've only heard about it and there it is, and they haven't bothered to put it online. You know, it's almost, the pages are paper thin, or, you know, it barely exists. It's made of tissue and you know it's going to disappear, but it's, I don't know, there's something about those, that kind of, it's not really technology, but it is sort of, you know, books and magazines. So a lot of things. I could go on for a long time, obviously. I like stuff.
That's I love that so much. And now, I guess, to wrap things up a little bit, turning back to the North. So you're a key figure in Canada's contemporary music scene, and your works have been performed globally. So what do you think it means to be a Canadian composer, especially in today's musical landscape?
Wow, that's a really heavy question in many ways. It's really difficult. I still don't know how to answer that, really. I mean, it means, I can say, of course, that it means a huge amount to be involved in the music scene in Canada and globally. Of course, I love that, and I'm happy and to be involved, you know, as I travel around the world, or my pieces are being performed and there'll be other Canadians there, or, you know, I'm introduced as being from Canada. I'm so pleased and proud of that. And also it goes, you know, I'm also was born in Saskatchewan. So there's Saskatchewan representing, and people will bring that up, and there's a warmth. I feel, you know, there's a beauty in that I love. But as for what it, apart from that, apart from the pride and the gratitude and the, you know, the excitement, I'm not sure how to answer what it means to be Canadian. You know, it just means, I guess it means, you know, there's an artistic freedom, I suppose, but that can be said for many artists around the world. Yeah, so it's a very difficult. I think that I would a answer that question at the end of my life, maybe, where I would know, I'd have more. Right now, I'm just in it. I'm sort of involved, embedded in it, and learning, still learning and discovering, and I'm really involved in that. So I haven't been able to sit back and sort of assess what it all means yet. Yeah.
It's a never-ending journey, really, of self-discovery.
Yeah. I do. I believe that. Because, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's okay. I don't think that there has to be sort of an assessment of it. I don't know. It's not, I like, but I do like being in the conversation with other artists and discussing that, because it'll lead to something, even if we never answer that question, and that's okay. There are unanswered questions, and but I like the conversations about what it all means. That's always been intriguing.
That's beautiful. Well, that's it for today's episode. So thank you so much, Nicole, for sharing such beautiful pieces of your art and heart.
Thanks so much, Brianna. This has been wonderful. Thank you for the excellent questions. It's really been a pleasure speaking with you.
Until next time, folks, keep listening for the Notes of the North.